Big show on Tuesday, July 2nd. First, we tackle the question of whether or not foreign-born doctors trained in foreign-born medical schools are competent enough and qualified to practice here in the U.S. Then author Mati Friedman joined us. He's written a fascinating book about the humble origins of the Israeli Mossad. We spoke to Dominic Amori from the Hartford Courant. He checked in to give his thoughts on penalties handed down to UConn and their former men's head basketball coach Kevin Ollie. And finally, Bob Gargiulo joined us heading into the July 4th holiday observance. He's the state executive director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. We talked about the ongoing drunk driving problem, which is particularly high here in Connecticut. And I added a few of my own thoughts on the latest from Colin Kaepernick.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
Yeah, you are. Our number 2-203-333 WICC 203-333-9422. Paul Pacelli here, the world famous Aaron Johnson on the other side of the glass. Hope all is well with you and yours today. Not a bad day, about 80 degrees. Coming up bottom of the hour, we'll talk to UConn beat writer Dom Amori about some of these penalties being levied against UConn. They won't miss the NCAAs, but they're going to have to pull back some wins from previous seasons. If you won money on those games, do you have to give it back now? I'm just you know. Aaron, did you win any? Did you win cash on those games? You're going to have to give all that money back when they recuse these wins?
I will not say either way whether or not I won any money or not.
You refuse? What's the word? I refuse to acknowledge or deny that. Anyway, before that, we're pleased to welcome a distinguished guest here to Connecticut Today. This gentleman is a journalist, contributor to the New York Times op-ed section. He's a former AP correspondent. He's reported all over the world, Israel, Lebanon, Morocco, Moscow, the Caucasus, Washington, D.C. You've read his work in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal. He can write. The gentleman's name is Mati Friedman. The name of the book, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. This sort of stuff just fascinates me. Mati, Paul here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on the show.
The genesis of this book, this all took place, or the subjects that you write about in this book took place in the post-World War II world, correct?
That's right. The action in the book takes place around the year 1948, which is 3 years after the end of the Second World War, and it's the year of Israel's creation and the war that we here in Israel call the War of Independence.
Now, Spies of No Country, obviously a person can read that and kind of get a notion of what is going on here, but talk a little about who these spies were, these actual men, who these spies were, and what they were tasked with at the time.
Sure. I mean, I think people who know something about Israeli intelligence have an idea of this very sophisticated operation, the Mossad, you know, this kind of spy service that has an international reputation. But the beginnings of all of this in 1948 are incredibly modest. The unit at the center of the book is called the Arab Section, and it's a very amateur kind of seat-of-the-pants unit of about a dozen guys who are picked up. Some of them are picked up from the street, and they're turned into spies because they have native Arabic and they can pass on the other side of enemy lines. That makes them very useful to the Jewish military underground before the founding of the state. So they're given some rudimentary training, some very basic equipment, and they're dispatched into the Arab world to provide intelligence for this new state, which at the beginning of the story isn't even a state yet. And that's the beginning, the very modest, almost pathetic beginning of this very famous spy system called the Mossad, which of course today is world famous.
Yeah, I mean, the Mossad today is, you know, people talk about that in the same breath with the American CIA and the Brits, whatever. I get confused, MI5 or MI6, whichever one is the international one. But, Mati, these, you say they were picked up off the street. I mean, I can see the scene playing out in my head now, that somebody walk up to these guys and say, hey, want to be a spy? Or did they know the background of these guys? How were they recruited? Did somebody literally go up to them and say, hey, are you interested in this? How did that work?
Well, in pre-state Israel, so in Israel before 1948, almost all of the Jews here in the country come from Europe, mostly Eastern Europe. there's a very small minority of people here who are Jews from the Arab world. They come from cities like Baghdad, like Aleppo, like Damascus. So when the state starts setting up its military, what will eventually become a military, and its intelligence service, they realize that these people, this small minority in the country, that these guys are very useful. And these are the guys who they need, because they need people who can pass using Arab identities on the other side of enemy lines. And these kids often were living in the country without parents. Some of them were orphans.
Really?
Some of them were on the street. One of my characters, who I actually interviewed and who's still alive at 94, he was selling green peppers from a crate in a vegetable market on the street when he was picked up and taken to this camp where the Arab section trained its guys, and he was given a new identity.
Wait a minute.
He had native Arabic and could pass. He was useful, and that's how Israel created its first spies.
So, Mati, when you say picked up, he was, I mean, literally, I'm trying to get a picture of this for my listeners. So this gentleman who you say is still alive at 94 in his mid-90s, he was selling peppers, like what, minding his own business, and somebody physically came and scooped him up and took him away? Is that how it worked?
So this particular spy is named Isaac Shoshan, and he grew up in Aleppo, Syria, very poor Jewish family, kind of an alley kid. He grew up barefoot in the alleys of Aleppo, and when he was a teenager, he decided to run away. And he ran away from Syria to British Mandate Palestine to join the Zionist movement. He thought that was his way out. He understood there was no future for Jews in the Arab world, and he understood that what awaited him was a future of poverty and kind of a dead end. So he runs away, and he ends up in Tel Aviv, which is a new city at the time. It's a city that's about 30 years old, and he's living hand-to-mouth. He's selling green peppers from a crate. That's what he's doing. And that, he didn't have another plan, but he was spotted by recruiters for this operation called the Arab Section, and they realized what he was worth, and they realized that these kids could pass using Arab identities and that they were tough enough to execute these very complicated missions, which they were going to be sent on without adequate training, without adequate equipment. They weren't paid. There were no salaries. The military underground was very bare bones at the time. They couldn't afford to pay anybody. The Arab Section at the beginning of its operations didn't own a camera. So they were sent out to gather intelligence with a borrowed camera. They kind of borrowed it from a civilian who they knew. They didn't even have a camera. And when they were dispatched into the Arab world to set up what becomes Israel's first intelligence station in the spring of 1948, they don't have a radio. They have no way to communicate because Israeli intelligence does not own a radio. In the spring of 1948. That's what I mean when I say the beginnings of the Israeli intelligence apparatus are incredibly modest, and that's this story of about a dozen guys who created it more or less out of nothing.
So it sounds like, Mati, and the guest is Mati Friedman, it sounds like they were targeting guys who, like you say, didn't have maybe the strongest family ties, or guys who were looking for, forgive me if the term is a little flip, but looking for adventure? I mean, that's what it sounds like here.
I think some of them were looking for adventure. I think some of them were looking for a way into this incredibly compelling movement, the Zionist movement. Mm-hmm. They were committed to the cause. They were committed to the cause of creating a Jewish state, and they were willing to die for it, and they were willing to do this incredibly dangerous work without getting paid, and that made them very useful. And with really very little training, these guys were not university graduates. In fact, only one of the characters in this book had finished high school. So they were uneducated. They were kind of street kids, but they were very tough, and they were very resourceful, and they were very, very brave. And they end up being successful, even though it should be said that of about a dozen spies active in the Arab Section at the beginning of the 1948 war, only about half of them survived.
MIT, you talk about here back, what, about 8 years ago in 2011, first hearing somebody tell you about that story. Talk about that.
I was writing my first book, which is called The Aleppo Codex, and it's an account of the most important copy of the Bible in Hebrew. It's a manuscript with a very interesting and kind of dirty story. And one of the guys who I was interviewing for that book was himself an old spy, not involved in the Arab Section, but a guy with an interesting track record in Israeli intelligence. And he recommended that I meet a friend of his who was an even older spy. And I wasn't sure exactly why I was going to meet this guy, but I have learned, and I write this in the book, I've learned over years as a journalist that if someone offers to introduce you to an old spy, you should just go.
Just take
it. It's never going to be a waste of time.
Yeah.
Just grab that opportunity and get in the car and go. So I drove down from Jerusalem to the city of Bat Yam, which is a suburb of Tel Aviv, and I met this very, very old spy. He was then close to 90. That's Isaac Shoshan, who is now 94. And he told me a story as I sat in his kitchen, a story about the 1948 war that I had never heard before. I'd never heard of the Arab section, and I'd never heard of the exploits of Shoshan and his comrades in that war. And I kept on going back. I took my digital recorder, and I kept on going back to see Isaac and asking him more and more questions. And I got hours and hours of him on tape, and I realized that this was a pretty incredible and unknown story about the moment of Israel's birth.
If you go to the public relations people, if those exist at the Mossad or to the Israeli government, prior to your book, if I went there and asked them about this, would they have acknowledged it? Was there ever a great deal written on this? What level of knowledge is there about this section?
It wasn't secret, but there was very little written about it. There were two books written in Hebrew over the years, both of them not widely read and now out of print and never translated. So if you talk to an average Israeli, they've never heard of the Arab section. Certainly people who read in English, people who are interested in Israel from outside of the country, have never heard this story. It was completely new to me when I started looking into it, and I think that's going to be true for most readers.
Yeah, talk a little more about their training. You said there was, what, about a dozen or so? Not all of them stayed in or survived. How were they trained? Were other countries involved in this, say, any of the allies, the U.S., Britain, France, or was it all very secretive and internal?
It's actually very interesting. This unit starts with the British during the Second World War in 1941. It looks like the British are about to lose the war. The Americans aren't in the war yet. The Germans are coming through Russia and North Africa, and things are going very, very poorly, and it seems that the German army is about to capture the British Mandate territory of Palestine, mm-hmm. which is now the state of Israel, and the British kind of freak out, and the Jewish population here also freaks out for obvious reasons. They realize that something very bad is about to happen, and the British start setting up these units in British Palestine where they realize they have a Jewish population that is very useful for espionage because the Jews here have come from other countries, which means they can pass for other nationalities. So they set up one section called the German section, which is made up of German Jews who are trained to pass as Nazi soldiers. They're trained in Wehrmacht uniforms. They're trained to sing German army songs, and they're supposed to pass as German soldiers. And at the same time, they set up something called the Arab section, which takes Arabic-speaking Jews and trains them to be British agents behind German lines. And then at the end of 1941, 1942, the course of the war changes, and El Alamein happens, and Stalingrad, and the German advance is kind of blunted, and it becomes clear that the Germans are, that the tide has shifted and the Americans enter the war, and the British are less concerned about the fate of Palestine. So they kind of get rid of these little intelligence units that they'd set up here, and the Arab section is picked up by the Jewish military underground, which realizes that they have something very useful because the smartest of the Jewish leaders here understood that eventually there's going to be a war with the Arab world. Mm. And if you're going to have a war with the Arab world, you better have spies who can speak Arabic and pass on the other side of enemy lines.
So these folks that were recruited, it was generally for, I guess, eyes and ears. You said it was very low tech. I'm thinking, Matee, that none of these guys were buzzing around in, you know, in a Jaguar like James Bond had with, you know, flamethrowers out the back or any weapons in their shoes. So I guess it was all about eyes and ears and reporting back what they saw and heard.
Right, it wasn't low tech at the beginning. It was no tech. Literally, they had nothing. They had not even a radio. They were dispatched to Lebanon to set up the first intelligence station with no way to communicate. They had no technology at all. Eventually, things start becoming more serious. The state is declared in May 1948, and the intelligence services are formed officially, and they begin to have budgets, and things become more and more professional. These guys start out gathering intelligence, so they would dress up as itinerant barbers or itinerant peddlers and go into Arab villages and kind of chat people up and sniff around and come back with some information. And then they graduate to sabotage, and then they graduate to an attempted assassination. And by the end of the Arab section, which is the spring of 1950, things are becoming more serious. They're starting to resemble a real spy service, something that would be more familiar to us today.
Was anybody in the early stages of this, Mati, was anybody onto them? Were anything they were doing as well as they tried to stay undercover? Anybody start to sniff out what they might be doing, or were they just so undercover that it was effective?
No, absolutely. The other side was onto them very quickly. Within a few weeks of the beginning of the war, the Arab side understands that the Jews are up to something, and they become very suspicious of strangers walking around cities with claiming to have Arab identities. And almost immediately after the beginning of the war, which is in December 1947, two Arab section agents in the city of Jaffa are caught, and their cover is very flimsy. Their cover stories are very amateurish. Again, they're not very well trained. They didn't really know how to withstand pressure, mm-hmm. and they're executed, and their bodies are only found 40 years later. And a few days later, a third Arab section agent is caught in similar circumstances and is never found. And that happens to a few other of these guys. They weren't well trained, so things were fine unless they really came under scrutiny. And once they came under scrutiny, it was very hard for them to really pull it off.
Sure.
That's why I have about a dozen of these guys. Only half of them survived. They were sent out into a really chaotic situation, more or less unprepared. Some of them were lucky, and some of them weren't.
And as you say, as we wind up here, Mati, as you say, this is the origin of the modern-day Mossad.
That's right. This is how it starts. And if you know the mythology of the Mossad, it's almost funny to see how low-tech and how bare-bones and how seat-of-the-pants this whole operation was. But this is one of the most important seeds that eventually becomes the legendary spy service known as the Mossad.
So who's on the list to play these guys in the movie? Any George Clooney, Johnny Depp, hopefully this does get to the big screen. It sounds like it'll be, honestly, I think movies like this, if you can get this made, they're entertaining, and they tell an important story, you know, Mati?
Well, I think if, you know, Steven Spielberg is listening to this radio broadcast, you know, Give me a call. I'm available, but George Clooney will have to play me.
Yeah, listen.
Be available to play any of the spies, but we can work it all out.
Mr. Spielberg made, of course, you and I know, Munich, about tracking down the assassins in the Olympics, and that was a very moving movie, as far as I'm concerned. So if you can get, Mati, I'll say it right now, if you can get a transcript or a copy of this to Steven Spielberg, who knows? Guest has been Mati Friedman. The name of the book is Spies of No Country. It's a fascinating book, and Mati, we thank you for joining us from overseas, and we wish you well. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Thanks. There it is, folks. Check it out. Learn some history. That's why I like having these sort of authors on. Mati Friedman, name of the book, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives of the Birth of Israel. How about that? The Mossad starts with about a dozen guys who they picked up off the street. Six of them survive. And that was the start of the Israeli Mossad. Are you kidding me? It's amazing stuff. And welcome back to Connecticut Today. I'm Paul Pacelli. You know, by the year 2032, the U.S., get this, folks, will face a shortage of doctors. That's according to some estimates. Could be as high as 122,000 physicians in both primary and specialty care. Now, at the same time, the number of cancer cases in the country expected to rise, jumping by as high as 45%. Now, amid all this, doctors educated at foreign medical schools who come to the U.S. to train are fulfilling a critical need here. And here to explain that, a couple of guests for you today, Dr. William W. Pinsky. He's president and CEO of the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, or ECFMG. And along with Dr. Pinsky is Dr. Beatrice Wills, a native of Colombia who's trained in the U.S. since 2016. Hello to both of you, and welcome to Connecticut Today. We appreciate the time.
Hi. I'm happy to be here with you.
Thank you, Paul.
Dr. Pinsky, let's talk about this shortage. You know, we've been reading and hearing about this for years and years and years. I've been hearing it from my own doctors and specialists I go to, and now I guess we're kind of reaching critical mass on this.
You're correct. I mean, we have been hearing this for years because it's been real for years. And I think it's getting a little bit of extra attention right now because of people like me, the baby boomers who are now older and requiring more health care, is probably making the situation even more critical. But we've recognized that we've had a deficit of physicians for many years. And you know, there's been an increase in the number of both allopathic and osteopathic medical schools in the United States in the last decade, and also class size has increased. But the demand continues to outstrip the need, and as it has been since World War II, and the international medical graduates play a prominent role.
So, and we've heard of American doctors and American medical students that go to foreign medical schools to do some of their training and come back here. But now you say the influx of foreign doctors and those born overseas training in the U.S. is of utmost importance.
Yes, and actually both groups are, both U.S. citizens that go offshore to other countries, as well as those who are foreign nationals, are both very, very important. And it's also important, though, for the public to know that individuals who've gone to medical school outside the U.S. and Canada are appropriately screened and credentialed to be able to come back here to then further their education and possibly practice in this country. And that's exactly the role that ECFMG does.
Dr. Beatrice Wills, once again, thank you for joining us today. What inspired you to go into the field of oncology, and talk about your decision to come to the U.S. for training?
My dad inspired me to pursue oncology after he was diagnosed with lung cancer. I met his oncologist, who introduced me to this beautiful field where there's a lot of research behind cancer, and then I will be able to build really strong relationships with patients who have cancer. And I decided to train in the United States because I want to become the best possible oncologist, and I knew it was here where I would have access to the best technology and really frontier medicine, along with the most fantastic and worldwide leaders in the field.
That's got to be interesting, Dr. Wills. Not only are you coming to a foreign country to train, but you're also adapting to a new culture and a different culture while you're in the middle of training. And that's got to be, I would think that's especially challenging. Even though it might be fun and adventurous, you've kind of got a two-pronged thing you're looking at here personally.
Yes, absolutely. It was challenging, particularly the first year it was. I mean, English is not my first language. The culture is different, but I fortunately adapted quickly, and I had amazing support both from my family, my friends, and my mentors. My Johns Hopkins was really welcoming, so they made it easier for me.
You know, I would imagine, you know, you have your home culture, there's the American culture, and then there's the culture, Dr. Wills, of physicians, the doctor's culture, the medical culture that kind of cuts through and unites everyone.
Yes, that's absolutely true. There's a lot of difference, but I think diversity precisely brings progress. So I think it's a great opportunity that we all have different backgrounds.
Back to you, Dr. Pinsky. When you a moment ago, I found something interesting you said, and I've always wondered when folks are perhaps maybe finding a new physician or going to a practice for the first time, and they don't see the traditional sheepskin or medical degree, the primary degree from their physician before they come over here to train. You talked about making sure they're properly credentialed. How does somebody go about doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question and great information for patients. So what we do when we get, you know, 20,000 applications a year, we do something called primary source verification, where we ascertain that the individual is exactly who they say they are, that their medical school diploma and transcripts are legitimate, and we work with the Department of Treasury, U.S. Department of Treasury, to be assured that they don't have anything in their background that should preclude them from coming to the United States. So it's a very thorough background check. And that their medical school is legitimately licensed in the country from where they come. It is then that we can register them to take the United States medical licensing exam, as the other physicians take to become licensed here. So patients, when they look at the diploma on the wall and then look at their training programs in the United States, because for a physician to be licensed in the United States, they have to do their residency training here as well. They can be well assured that their doctor has gone through this arduous process and has passed it, and that's why that they're certified.
I would imagine, Dr. Pinsky, that there are some very, very good and highly credible medical schools overseas and in other countries that when you or other professionals hear that the applicant is legitimately from one of these schools, it's a sigh of relief and it's a no-brainer that they would get approved to practice here, pending their passing the exams.
Right. Well, you raise a really an interesting point, because the certification process historically has been all about the individual. And recently, we've been working with the World Federation of Medical Education, which is based outside of Geneva, Switzerland, to develop an accreditation process for schools around the world that really would harmonize the standards for medical schools around the world. So people would have a certain expectation, knowing that when individuals are from one of these accredited schools, that the proper standards have been met.
And finally, Dr. Wills, for you, be that as it may, accreditation classes here, classes overseas, wherever you come from, the bottom line is medicine, correct? And no matter what language someone speaks or where they went to school, it's all about treating the patient correctly.
That's absolutely right. We have our human physiology works the same way, regardless of your ethnicity, regardless of your sex, gender, or country. So I agree with you.
Thank you, folks. It's been great. Our guests have been Dr. William W. Pinsky, President and CEO of the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, or ECFMG. You can look him up. And Dr. Beatriz Wills, a native of Colombia, who was trained in the U.S. since 2016. Thank you both, and continued good luck. We do appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This gentleman I've known for a long time. We used to occupy a newspaper newsroom together. Those were some halcyon days. Dominic Amore joins us, Hartford Current. He's covered the Yankees. He covers UConn for us. And Dom, it's been too long. How are you, man?
Not bad, Paul. How you been?
I'm all right. I'm all right, buddy. Surprised or not at some of the UConn news we heard today? Or was this kind of, or were people resigned to the NCAA was going to do something or not?
No, there's no surprises, I don't think, today. I think this is pretty much what everyone expected, and obviously for UConn, it's the best case scenario, because they threw the book at Kevin Ollie and basically left UConn alone to move forward with its program. So it kind of strengthens UConn's case in trying to avoid paying Kevin Ollie the remainder of his contract, but it doesn't hamstring Dan Hurley in his recruiting or the program in any significant way going forward.
Yeah, because I didn't see it at first, and I was mistaken when I said and corrected it. So UConn will not have to they won't go on probation for any possible tournament berths. This is all pointed to Kevin Ollie.
Yeah, all probation means is we have to monitor and report what they're doing a little bit more diligently than someone who's not on probation. And so they keep a little closer eye on them for 2 years. And, of course, if they do have an infraction while they're on probation, then that makes it worse. But for the most part, no, there's no tournament ban. You know, they docked a scholarship for next year. And they have, I think there's one less official visit that a recruit can make next year to UConn. So that's the the extent of it. It's not something, as I said, that would really hamstring Dan Hurley at all.
Yeah, and I was trying to tell people earlier in the show here, Dom, you and I both know the whole thing about docking visits and unofficial visits and phone calls and all this and interactions with possible players. You know, the NCAA manual is just it's a minefield. It's just a jungle to go through to make sure, not only with basketball, Dom, on both sides of the male-female, but with football, with hockey, with every sport. I mean, there are very, very specific rules that, you know, there's very little wiggle room in here.
Well, it gets in, you know, obviously you have to have rules and you have to enforce them. And the rules are naturally going to be somewhat complicated. But I also think that that book is filled with a lot of rules that I don't know that they necessarily, you know, need to be in there.
Yeah.
But that it governs anything that is of any significance at all. I mean, for instance, you know, I was doing an interview with a UConn golfer when he was on his way to the NCAA tournament, and there was some question whether the SID could set that interview up for me, or whether I would have to, whether he could actually. there's actually a question there. We had to like do it like away from a certain office or so many feet away from a certain office. I mean, that's how ridiculous a lot of these rules get. So so I'm not sure that a lot of these rules have unintended consequences. But you know, the rules that were broken here, you know, really small potatoes compared to some of the rule breaking that's going on elsewhere. But they nevertheless were somewhat significant rules being broken.
So, Dama, as you said, the bigger point here is likely in the school's ongoing fight with Kevin Ollie, who says, listen, pay me my money if you're just going to make a coaching change. And UConn is saying, no, you did stuff here. You know, we're firing you for cause, for just cause, for violations. Where do you think this whole thing ends up?
Well, I mean, the way it should end up is these two sides should get together and meet in the middle somewhere. I would say maybe a little bit closer to UConn's figure, which is zero, than Kevin's figure, which is $10 billion. And perhaps with the new president coming in on August 1st, he'll look at it with a different pair of eyes. He's not dug in on it, and maybe you could see some movement there. That's the best scenario. But obviously, if it does go to arbitration, which is an all-or-nothing scenario, you know, what happened today strengthens UConn's case on paper. In as much as, you know, if the NCAA has decided that these are major offenses or level one violations by Kevin, and he's got this show cause order, which pretty much keeps him out for 3 years, then that would strengthen UConn's position that his infractions rise to the level of just cause. But you never know what an arbitrator is going to do. This is basically a union versus management case. And an arbitrator could look at it and say, well, you know, I'm not bound by what the NCAA says. I don't think that he's been dealt with fairly. And then it could change. So I think that, you know, certainly on paper it strengthens UConn's case. I think UConn has all the momentum in this case, particularly in the court of public opinion. But you just never know what an arbitrator will do if it gets that far.
And, you know, Dom, some of these things I was reading in the first hour, what they were, you know, the training sessions, the, you know, the pickup games, you know, with the manager there, the former managers there, getting the stats. So, yeah, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where you and I have covered a rodeo here once or twice. Well, we know, you know, the common person's going to say, come on, shouldn't the coach know that this is happening? Why does this continue to happen? And I had a caller the first hour, Dom, of the show who said, you know, he came in, Ollie did, off of, you know, the Calhoun years, which weren't spit shine clean either. Why does this sort of thing keep happening? That was his question.
Well, you know, schools have violations of this type all the time.
Yeah.
And self-report them. And a lot of them, you know, are resolved and you don't even hear about them. I mean, things like, you know, maybe a workout that shouldn't happen or a pickup game that shouldn't happen or that kind of thing. You know, these things obviously came to light. Obviously, they were used by UConn and it's to make its case against Kevin. But the point that is key here, particularly in his arbitration case, is that, you know, when he was hired, it was on pretty much on the heels of the violations and the the sanctions of the Calhoun era, the late Calhoun era. And he was hired explicitly. It was made clear publicly and in writing that UConn did not want to go down this road again. His mandate was to stay out of trouble. And so for him, it's not as easy as saying, well, you know, Calhoun got away with this, that, and the other thing, and they didn't even fire him. You know, why is Kevin getting this treatment? Well, it's because after Calhoun, Kevin was hired on the condition that we don't want to go through this again. So that's part of it. Yeah, again, I do differentiate, Paul, these violations from things like, you know, dropping off bags of money here and there.
Where can I get a gig like that, Dom? I'm waiting for people to drop off sacks of money to me. It hasn't happened yet. And, you know, finally, Dom, on this, UConn, for all intents and purposes, when the Whalers left, UConn became our major league team, both the UConn men and women. So I think especially here, Dom, in a state where, frankly, we don't have that much more going on, this reverberates a little bit, even though, as you say, in the grand scheme of things, these are kind of minor infractions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the postseason ban for UConn is, you know, 3 years without being in the postseason for this program already seems like it was forever. The postseason ban that they have for 1 year due to academics, that seemed like forever, and that was a postseason that they deserved to go. Might have made a run that year, 2013, because you know what they did the next year. But, yeah, the point is here at UConn or in Connecticut, it's the biggest market in the country where one college basketball program is the biggest thing in it, or a men's and women's program are the biggest things in it.
Yeah.
But even places like Kentucky, they have two schools.
Yep.
You know, even places like North Carolina, where they have hockey and football, and they have other schools. But this is a top 30 market where the men's and women's basketball has become the biggest thing in it.
Yep.
And so they're covered like NBA teams. They're covered by the media like professional teams. And that's something that coaches who come in, like Dan Hurley, have to adjust to. But he seems to really like it. He likes the fact that he's got surrounded by beat writers like an NBA coach. He seems to like that. So, I mean, that's if you take that the right way, there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of notoriety, but there's also a lot of reward, because I don't know if there's any place in the country that goes all out to celebrate like Connecticut when those teams win.
No, and when the women only win by 35, Gino's right. He makes a joke. You know, they look, what's wrong with the UConn women? You know? When they only won by 30. Hey, Don, one quick question or one thought I'd love to get from you. And we don't know what the deal is, but you covered the Yankees for years, and a lot of people with a little raised eyebrows today. Maybe it's nothing, but John Sterling announcing early today, we carry Yankee baseball, of course, here on WICC. John Sterling going to miss games for the first time in 30 years. Obviously, in all your years covering the Yankees, you bumped into him, you knew him.
Right.
I mean, we forget that the guy's going to turn 81 this week, Don.
Yeah. Yeah, well, of course, John wrote the foreword to my book, A Franchise on the Rise, which is available wherever fine books are sold, if anyone wants to take a look at that.
Yeah.
No, John's a good friend of mine. You know what? I think it's a long delayed reference to how old he is. He's 81. This traveling schedule is just grueling. Takes a lot out of you. Now it involves an overseas trip. I know he wanted to be at his triplet children's graduation, and that's coming up. So I know that was a big factor as well. But, you know, we're all human, and, you know, I just hope he's feeling well and it's not anything long term. But you know, hey, we're all human, and even John's human too. To do this many games in a row and not miss one.
Oh.
Quite spectacular.
And we should mention that, yes, Dom's book, A Franchise on the Rise, the first 20 years of the New York Yankees, written by Dom Amore, forward by John Sterling, and maybe driven. Did he say driven by Jeep? Just kidding. Hey, Dom, great to talk to you again, buddy. I know you also have, producer here, Aaron Johnson, as a friend, so this guy's top shelf, too, let me tell you that.
Well, Aaron was a student of mine at Southern Connecticut, and one of many who've gone from my class up to big careers in the business. So I'm extremely proud of him, and I'm glad that you guys are working together.
Dom, it's great to hear from you again, buddy. We'll get together for some milkshakes. Be good, man.
You got it, Paul. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Dom Amore there, Hartford Current, covers UConn. Taught my producer Aaron at Southern, used to hang with me in the New Haven Register newsroom many years ago. His book, A Franchise on the Rise, the first 20 years of the New York Yankees, with a foreword by John Sterling. who's going to take a little time off. God bless him. He's 81. 81. I hope I can get out of bed when I'm 81. Bob Garzullo, Bob, Estate Executive Director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You heard of MAD form way back in 1980. Wow, so we're at 39 years that we've been having MAD in and around the country and the state. Bob, Paul Pacelli here. How are you, man? Good to talk to you again.
Good, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know what? I know you guys do a great job, Bob, you guys and gals, but it's really, when you think about it, it's too bad, and no reflection on what you do, it's too bad that an organization like yours really has to exist and to get the message out every year. The fact that people, Bob, no matter what we say, we still have to have organizations like yours to tell people something that should be common sense.
Most definitely. And, you know, the most alarming part of that is we're losing over 10,000 people each year as a result of individuals driving while intoxicated. And that's, you know, that's unacceptable for any country. And, you know, we're very concerned here in the state of Connecticut because we have the highest percentage of fatal crashes involving alcohol by far. So the national average is about 28% mm-hmm. of all crashes involve alcohol. In Connecticut, it's 43%.
Wow. Bob, before you told me that, I had no idea. Wow.
Yeah, it's an alarming rate, and we don't know why. You know, normally the first question is, why is that? And, you know, anyone's guess would be better than mine. I mean, I have no idea. We work very hard to educate the community. We work with parents. We work with the youth, obviously working closely with law enforcement. Just no one has a firm grasp on why that is here in the state of Connecticut, why we think we can get behind the wheel of a vehicle and drive after having a few cocktails. It's just unbeknown to us at this point.
Yeah, you know, Bob, in promoting your appearance here, I said, listen, I said, when I was young, as we all were, I said I did some very stupid things. I'd probably driven drunk maybe twice or three times in my life. The third time I did it, it was probably about 35 years ago. And, you know, it was honestly, Bob, I'll tell you right here, right now, and on this radio program, it was the kind of night where I got home and I wondered how I made it. And I said, I am never, ever, ever going to do that again. And it really made an impression on me. And now, Bob, I have maybe 4 or 5 drinks a year. That's it. And I counted myself lucky as making it home that night.
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, we know that each year, each and every year, 10,000 people aren't as lucky as you. And, you know, some innocent, many, many innocent victims over... you know, our stats are from the year 2017. That's mm-hmm. what the National Highway Safety National Highway Transportation Safety Administration mm-hmm. provides to us. And of those 10,000, you know, to be exact, 10,874 individuals lost their lives in 2017. 1,147 of those were children, 12 and under. So. We have to be more cognizant. We have to think about what we're doing. There's just so many options available to all of us, so we don't have to get behind the wheel. So, you know, MAD is not against the consumption of alcohol. We want everyone to have a good time. You know, 4th of July, for instance, coming up, you know, have a great time. Celebrate. Mm-hmm. But have a plan before you go out, if you're going out. Have a plan. Who's going to drive you home? Or am I going to call Uber? Or am I going to take a cab? Or,
yeah.
You know, whatever. Just have a plan. That's all we're asking. We want you to be responsible. Do the right thing because you're putting yourself and others in harm's way.
Bob, tell us about MAD's campaign to eliminate drunk driving. What's that about?
Well, it's a blueprint that we have to end drunk driving once and for all. You know, our goal is that there'll be no more victims. And in order to do that, we've outlined 4 important initiatives. Mm-hmm. One is supporting law enforcement. You know, they're our heroes. They're our champions. They're enforcing the law, fulfilling our mission in doing so. And, you know, but we need more DUI enforcement to keep the road safe. And it's been proven that checkpoints can reduce drunk driving deaths by 17%. So I actually got some paper put across my desk today that shows us where there'll be sobriety checkpoints over this holiday weekend. So we're very pleased that state police are on board and many of the local departments as well.
I mean, heck, Bob, the police announce where they're going to be. How stupid do you have to be to call DUI when the cops tell you where they're going to be?
Exactly. And they do that because it also makes you think about what you're going to possibly go and do. You know, so they're out there, they're looking, they're trying to protect us, each and every one of us. And they're allowing you to know where it is so that you can, in your mind, say, well, then I shouldn't be doing this. Yeah. I should have a plan.
Yeah.
I should have a plan how I'm going to get home safely tonight or during the day or whatever. I mean, it's not only nighttime that these crashes occur. But second, the second initiative is in Connecticut, we have an all-offender ignition interlock device that has to be installed for anyone arrested for DUI. So the way it works in Connecticut, if you're arrested for DUI the first time offender, you'll go through what we call a victim impact panel. So it's court mandated in the state of Connecticut that you go through one of our panels that basically puts the offender face to face with many of our victims who we work with on a daily basis, a yearly basis. With the offenders, it's a 2-hour program. It talks about obviously the dangers, and you hear it firsthand from the victims. But you may also hear from an offender who was in their chair a number of years ago, and he or she will tell how that affected their life, that one mistake they made. So that's part of it. But all the first-time offenders will have to install an ignition interlock device within their car where it will remain for a period of 1 year, meaning you cannot start your vehicle without breathing into that and having a negative reading. That means that you are not intoxicated and you are good to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Periodically, as they're driving, they need to blow in it again to keep the car moving and so on and so forth. But you know, the advanced vehicle technology is the third initiative. So we know ultimately technology will be the one main force that will help us eliminate drunk driving. So cars will be equipped with safety devices so that no one would be able to start their vehicle.
Wow.
And would prevent drivers from driving, obviously.
Plus a lot, Bob, of the new vehicles you see coming with this crash avoidance technology, too, which, hey, if you're drunk and you're going to hit somebody, it's good that some of the new cars will automatically slam on the brakes if they see something as small as a pet or a small child in the way.
Exactly. And, you know, the newer autonomous vehicles also have a potential to eliminate many types of roadway deaths, including drunk driving. So that's another feature that we're looking for in the future to be more widespread and once again helping us reduce that number, that crazy number of 10,874 people. And then finally, public support. It's going to take everyone to eliminate drunk driving. You know, there are the options of Uber and taxis and public transportation. So there is no excuse to drive drunk. In fact, I hear some time where, you know, I didn't want to leave my car at the restaurant or the bar that I was at, so I felt it'd be better to drive. Well, there are a number of companies that will send two drivers to pick you up wherever you are.
There you go.
One will take you home and one will drive your car home. So when you wake up, whether it's morning, afternoon, day,
whenever you wake up,
your car will be there, so you don't have anything to worry about. So there is no excuse.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, Bob, you know what? And I'm sure you've heard this from people too in your line of work. You know, I know a couple of people who, you know, ran into trouble and luckily didn't get into an accident, didn't harm anyone, actually were pretty near getting home when, you know, they just nudge somebody in the car in front of them, cop shows up, make a long story short, you know, where the limit is .08, you think you're okay, Bob, and you blow a .09. And, you know, that results in, and you've probably heard these stories, Bob, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, $12,000 in court costs, your license, restricted for a year. That one extra drink, Bob, can really be costly.
Most definitely. And you know, is it worth it? And, you know, I think you and I can both agree that it is not worth it. We want you to have fun. Everybody wants to have fun and celebrate. That's great. Just have a plan. Think about it. You know, we're reading a lot about it, and we're working with the family of the young lady from West Haven who was severely injured in a drunk driving crash in Orlando. She wasn't behind the wheel. She wasn't drinking. Her and her friend were driving, simply stopped at a red light, rear-ended by a drunk driver. She now obviously paralyzed from the neck down. She's 22 years old. She had everything in life to live for. She had just gotten her ideal job at Disney World, and now it's totally gone, and that dream is gone, and it's not her fault. She had nothing to do with it. And, you know, that's what we need to stop. We need to prevent this so that there are no more victims. You know, we're going to be here regardless of whether people stop drinking and driving, because we're still working with victims. And we do that free of charge. We do it for a lifetime if that's what they need, because we have victims, obviously, many in the state of Connecticut that we're working with, and family members of victims who have passed as a result of those crashes. So we continue to work with them. Holidays come about, birthdays come about, anniversaries, et cetera. We're going to be here. Hopefully we're here only working for previous victims, not for future victims, and that would be our goal.
Bob, I would imagine that step one that you told me about, where you have people on first-time DUIs that have to face people who either did what they did or victims that encountered someone like the person that's in front of those people, I would imagine and hope that that's pretty effective, at least in some cases.
Most of the cases, you would hope that they walk away with a better understanding the mistake that they made, you know. And like you said, you've made that mistake. I probably did in years past, too. I'm more cognizant of it now. I think when you have children, you start realizing that, you know, you want to be more protective. So why would I put my children in harm's way? You know, I stop at a stop sign. I look each and every way.
Me too, both ways, yeah.
Because I've heard so many horror stories about, you know, daytime just going to lunch or going to the grocery store or what have you and being rear-ended or T-boned as a result of somebody running a red light or a stop sign because they were intoxicated. And, you know, you've got to bring drugs into the equation as well. So, you know, there is so much that people need to think about, but the main thing is just do the right thing. And the right thing is not to say I only had three drinks or four drinks, because you don't know how much that's affected you.
No, you don't know. Men versus women, big guy, small guy, how much you've eaten. No, absolutely. The MAD helpline, if you need the MAD, 24-hour victim helpline, 1-877-MAD-HELP, 877-MADDHELP. State Executive Director Bob Gargiulo, the Connecticut chapter of MAD. Bob, thank you. Great to hear from you again, and keep in touch.
Thank you, Paul. Happy and safe holiday to you and your listeners, and thanks for having me.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. We'll be in touch. Bob Gargiulo there, Connecticut chapter of MAD. And this is one of those things that can almost literally make my head explode. Listen, I'm all for people having their opinions. I'm all for people exercising their constitutional rights legally, lawfully. I'm all for people making as big a buck as they can. You know what my philosophy is on people? As long as you're making the money legally and you're not physically harming people in any way, then go right ahead, have at it. I'm not one of these lefties who says, oh, people shouldn't make a lot of money, there's no reason to be a billionaire. Shut up. I'm not like that. You want to make money, God bless you. I hope you have 15 houses, 35 cars, because you'll eventually have to pay someone to clean those houses, build those houses, sales tax on those cars, service those cars, whatever. I'm a firm believer in trickle down. Now, however, when I see stuff like this, this makes my eyes explode. Nike pulls Betsy Ross flag shoes after a complaint from Colin Kaepernick. Now, you obviously know Colin Kaepernick was pretty much blackballed from the NFL because he was the first guy to take a knee and the whole dust up with Donald Trump. He won a lawsuit. He was able to, I guess, he got a big payoff, something like $60 million, because no team would sign him, even though it's been documented that at least two teams, maybe a third, were willing to bring him in. But at least in one case, his psycho girlfriend told him not to go, but that's another story. Nike pulls Betsy Ross flag shoes after a Colin Kaepernick complaint. Who the hell is he? Look, he can complain whatever he wants about the racial inequities in America. He can complain about the way police handle certain cases. He can do whatever he wants to do. If he is wronged by an organization, you know, like the NFL, if he thinks he's blackballed, he went to court, he got his money, that's fine. I have nothing against that. No sweat off my back. And he's got this big endorsement deal with Nike. That's fine. I'm wearing a pair of Nikes right now. I don't care. Nobody's holding a gun to anyone's head to do this. But this is the kind of thing that tells you where we are in society right now. Listen to this, and let me know what you think about this. Is Kaepernick right on this? Or is this the kind of thing that just drives you crazy? 203-333-WICC, 333-9422. Nike has pulled a new 4th of July shoe featuring the Betsy Ross flag for the 13 American colonies, reportedly, after Colin Kaepernick expressed concerns, sparking outrage among some conservatives. Well, of course, see, now NBC's got to get the, you know, the conservative, because I'm sure no liberals are outraged by it. I'm sure NBC. Positive NBC. Sparking outrage by some conservatives and prompting Arizona's governor to announce his state is going to pull millions of dollars in financial incentives to the company. Now, the shoe design drew concern from Kaepernick. Why? It's a red, white, and blue shoe. The Betsy Ross flag on the back of it. You know what the Betsy Ross flag is? It's the flag we have now. But instead of having the 50 stars for the 50 states, it's got the circle of 13 stars representing the 13 individual colonies. You know that one. Some people fly it over their homes. Some people have it in their offices, right? Folks tell the Wall Street Journal the shoe design drew concern from Colin Kaepernick because the former NFL star said the flag has connections to slavery. In recent years, the Betsy Ross flag has been appropriated by the white nationalist group Identity Evropa, whatever the hell that means, and the Ku Klux Klan, who use it to represent a time when slavery was legal in the U.S. Who the hell cares? This is amazing. So because some sycophantic racist idiots choose to appropriate an acknowledged symbol of the founding of this country, suddenly we have to bow down and Nike has to show a complete lack of balls in this case? Oh, we're sorry. We're not going to sell it. Because a certain group of people, a certain group of reprobates, appropriated? Nobody else can wear it for the true meaning it has. I tell you, folks, we may be done. Nike said in a statement, Nike has chosen not to release the Air Max 1 Quick Strike 4th of July as it featured an old version of the American flag. So what? Nobody realized this when they were designing the shoe? Did this suddenly just, oh my God, look what happened. A small version of the flag showed up on the shoe. Yeah, it did. So what? On Twitter earlier Tuesday morning, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey announced he had ordered his state's Commerce Authority, a public-private economic development agency, to withdraw millions of dollars in incentives. The state offered Nike to build a plant in Goodyear, Arizona. Ducey saying, quote, "Today was supposed to be a good day in Arizona with the announcement of a major Nike investment in Goodyear, Arizona." He added, "Words cannot express my disappointment. Nike has made its decision, and now we're making ours." He went on to say Arizona's economy is doing just fine without Nike, saying that he won't suck up to the company. Good for you. Folks, I tell you something. Look, don't call me and lecture me about, well, the evils of slavery and everything. I get it. I know it. Okay? So now we're going to take every symbol that may have been around when the sins of slavery were around and suddenly say that's sinful because some modern-day idiots are appropriating it for their sick use? No. Why don't we be in clear of a mind as possible to go back and say, no, what's this really mean? Folks, if there's anything that symbolizes how screwed up this country is and the fact that we shake and quiver at what some people think, all you have to do is look at this. It is mind-boggling because Colin Kaepernick didn't like it and Nike's got millions of dollars, tens of millions, tied up with Colin Kaepernick. We're going to go this way? That is asinine beyond all concern.